Chicago author Kelly O'Connor McNee's latest work is a historical fiction account of a true relationship we haven't heard very much about, that of former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and the journalist Lorena Hickok.
I suspect that some people had, you know, ideas that there was more than just a friendship here, but it would have been just so beyond imagining for a lot of people who were around the Roosevelts to think that this would have been going on.
It's called Undiscovered Country. Plus, this May the 4th, we give you a preview of tomorrow's Free Comic Book Day. Here's Kevin Healy, the store manager of Graham Cracker Comic Books in DeKalb.
So you can get 3 free books per person, and we always encourage people to grab something you wouldn't normally read. The price is right. It's the exact right time to try something new. But for anybody who stops in a costume, we always give them 3 extra books on top of that.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Chicago-based writer Kelly O'Connor McNee's latest work is a fictional account of the love story between former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and the journalist Lorena Hickok. It's based on many real-life encounters of the two women, and it's an intimate look not just at their relationship, but the role both women had in shaping FDR's New Deal. If you're in the suburban Chicago area, Kelly's actually going to be doing a reading Monday night at 6:30 in Woodstock. It's sponsored by Read Between the Lines Bookstore. We'll tweet out information about that. Right now, she's with us at our Evanston studios at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to just start by asking, I think, the obvious question, which is when you think about these two women, there isn't that much that's written or discussed about them. I think especially as you would think even nowadays, why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think that Eleanor Roosevelt is someone who just looms large in a lot of people's imagination of a good chunk of the 20th century. And a big part of how they think about her has to do with her work, her role as First Lady, her role as a sort of role model for women during the Depression, household economy, and just living a certain type of life. And I think that in some ways has become such a stifling image of Eleanor that this information, this other part of her life that we know less about or have known less about until recently, sort of does not fit in very well with that image.
It doesn't fit the narrative, I guess, right?
Exactly.
Well, and it doesn't really fit. And I guess we also have, I mean, there is probably an interesting mythology that we have in this country around first ladies. And I think Eleanor Roosevelt is probably maybe the first one that we have held up with that role model.
Yes. And I think even that is interesting because the more that you know, we've sort of learned about her and her writings and some of the less public aspects of her life, we see that she actually dreaded becoming first lady. She didn't want this role. She thought that it would get in the way of doing the work that she wanted to do and the freedom that she had been able to establish for herself. So even the narrative itself is sort of built on a faulty premise.
So let's talk about these two women, in particular, the main character, Lorena Hickok. How did you first learn about her?
You know, I was reading a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, the first volume in Blanche Weisenkook's 3-volume biography of Eleanor, and sort of thinking about the possibility of writing fiction about Eleanor, but feeling that there was just so much known about her. We practically know where she was every day, every hour. And so it just seemed that there wasn't really a new story to be able to tell about her. But then as I was reading this biography, there's a chapter about Lorena Hickok, who was described as, you know, her close friend and possibly more based on these letters that they had exchanged and all of this time they had spent together in the early part of FDR's first term. And I was just so taken by this and surprised, first of all, that I had never heard of this woman before, but also intrigued, curious about why this had not been covered, why we haven't talked about this, what kind of role Hick played in Eleanor's life. And that was sort of the seed for starting to think about writing fiction about their relationship.
The novel's called Undiscovered Country. The author, Kelly O'Connor McNeese, who is Chicago-based, is talking to us right now on the 21st. And Kelly, to the point of those letters, before we even get to that, There are the facts of this relationship, and we don't know the details of it, but we do know that even at the beginning of the administration, the two women took a trip together, just the two of them by themselves for a couple of weeks.
Yes, this was a vacation for Eleanor, and Hick came along. And at this time, they had been involved in a romantic relationship for several months. But Eleanor had moved to Washington, D.C., and Hick was still in New York, so they were separated. And this trip was a way for them to sort of spend one last, you know, bit of time together before Eleanor's life became very complex and full with all of the duties and responsibilities of being First Lady. So they traveled through New England together, Eleanor driving them in her own car. They did somewhat have to try to avoid the press, but they went up into French Canada, and really no one knew who they were. So they were able to just move freely and enjoy some space and sort of get to see what it would be like if their lives were very different and they could actually be together in the way that they would have liked to be.
And at one point, Lorena is actually even lived in the White House. That in itself seems so surprising to me. But I guess I'm looking at it in the hindsight of how journalists cover the White House nowadays. And this is a White House that didn't even allow pictures of the president in a wheelchair, right?
That's true. Things have changed quite a bit. I think Eleanor and Hick were seen as very close friends. It's impossible to know because people who were contemporaries of theirs did not write about what they actually thought was going on. I suspect that some people had, you know, ideas that there was more than just a friendship here, but it would have been just so beyond imagining for a lot of people who were around the Roosevelts to think that this would have been going on. I think that because Hick was a journalist, that sort of gave cover to the fact that they spent so much time together. She was claiming to be writing a book about Eleanor, and she went on to do that later on. So there was this good explanation at any time that, you know, she was taking notes, she was interviewing her and collecting information for this book. And she did live in the White House. After she took her job with the federal government, she had to give up her apartment in New York, and Eleanor invited her to come. Now, this wasn't totally unusual. There were other writers and sort of people, friends in the circle of the Roosevelts who did live in the White House at different times, but Hick was right near Eleanor's, you know, private rooms, and they spent an awful lot of time together.
And so that brings us to the letters. Can you tell us about these letters and when you first discovered all of the letters between them?
So I learned of the existence of the letters in this biography that I mentioned earlier, and I learned that there were well over 3,000 of them and probably many, many more that had been destroyed. These letters are in the FDR archive, which is in Hyde Park, New York, and contains all of the papers of the Roosevelts and people in their circle, such as Lorena Hickok and lots of other people who had work with them and influence on policy. So I was able to go to the FDR archive and actually see these letters. And I will say that, you know, it's one thing to imagine these and even to read transcriptions of them in books, but to see the letters themselves handwritten was really something quite amazing.
And can you give us an example of what some of the letters contain, Kelly?
Well, it's interesting because they were separated, because Eleanor moved to D.C. and Hick was still in New York. They wrote back and forth a lot. And I guess if you think about the way that we stay in communication with our partners now, many, many times throughout the day, it's not so surprising, but they did sometimes exchange more than two letters a day. And they were a mixture of things, very newsy, just what they were up to, who they had had lunch with that day. Of course, Eleanor's calendar was full to the brim with 1,000 different commitments and meetings and committees. And they also talked about politics and things that were happening, things they were concerned about. When Hick took her job as a federal investigator for the New Deal project, she traveled all over the country to different towns to report on what was happening there, and that information would be used to sort of shape New Deal policy. So sometimes she talked about those things. But then, of course, they always signed off with love, talked about how much they were missing each other, counted the days until they would see each other again, talked about what they looked forward to being able to do, if they had had an argument, because they also talked by phone. So sometimes in the letters, you wouldn't know quite what they were referencing because it was a conversation that had happened over the phone. But maybe they would have an argument because Hick was feeling jealous or ignored, and then Eleanor would write her a letter the next day and say, I'm so sorry, and please let's try again. And so there was a lot in them, a lot of emotion.
I'm speaking with Kelly O'Connor McNeese. We're talking about her historical fiction account of the relationship between former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and the journalist Lorena Hickok. Kelly, from historians' perspective, is it pretty much acknowledged that they were in a relationship, these two?
I think that most historians, yes, do acknowledge that it would be sort of naive to say that this was just a very, very close friendship. There are some things in the letters that are sort of hard to explain away, although for a long time people did try to do just that, because I think they were not able to handle the question of whether this was a romantic relationship, and just really didn't know how to deal with that information. So I would say that most of them have accepted this. I'm sure there are still people who have differing opinions, and of course only the two people who are in a relationship can know, you know, the exact nature of it. But yes, I would say so.
And why did you choose to tell their story in a historical fiction account?
Well, I'm a fiction writer, so that's my take on these things. I'm interested in the ways that fiction can help us learn a certain kind of truth that we can't know through evidence, through historical fact, emotional truths that involve sort of understanding what it was like to be in a person's shoes in a given situation. And there are limits to how much nonfiction can answer those questions. So I think inventing scenes, imagining dialogue, imagining what it was like to be on that vacation that they took and what they might have been going through, each of them personally and then together in their relationship, that's sort of the domain of fiction, and that's what really interests me.
And so in your experience, how do historians respond to historical fiction?
You know, I think it varies. I think that the sort of old school view would be that this maybe isn't helpful or that it shouldn't be seen as a way of learning about what actually happened. On the other hand, I think it can be seen as something that enriches the picture. I wouldn't ever want anyone to read a historical novel to find out exactly what happened in a given historical event, but I think fiction can bring these people and these difficult situations to life in a way that helps readers connect and understand. So I think, of course, we need both.
And I think for me, as I was reading your book, it was such an interesting account of the Great Depression. You know, you learn about this in school or in college, but reading the firsthand, the accounts that you wrote of Hick and her traveling around the country and interviewing people who were in really dire, impoverished situations, was much of that work actually based on the oral history that she actually did in real life?
Yes. This is another part of Hick's life that was so fascinating to me, and I couldn't believe I had never learned about, which was that she had this job working for Harry Hopkins, who was the administrator of the New Deal, and he wanted to hire people who could go out into the country all over and to lots of rural areas and urban areas and sort of report back to him on what was life like for people on the ground. What were the struggles that people were having? Because all of the funding that came through the New Deal was administered on the local level. So even though, you know, in theory, the same amount of aid was being distributed everywhere, it depended on how well the local government was functioning and all different kinds of problems that were sort of clogging up the pipeline and making it difficult for people to get the help that was supposedly coming to them. He had a lot of data on that, but what he wanted was the storytelling angle. He wanted to know what real people's lives were like. So Hick was actually the first one who was hired for this job. Then many others followed. And she visited all kinds of different places and wrote these incredible reports, which she sent to him. She would cable them to him each night from whatever hotel room she was in. She drove thousands of miles across the country visiting these places. And she would also send these reports to Eleanor. And so that was another piece of their ongoing communication throughout this period. One of the first places that Hick visited was rural West Virginia outside Morgantown, and just was shocked to see the conditions that these families were living in, who formerly had been employed in the coal mines, but these coal mines were now closed, and these families were basically just living in tents with no running water, no sanitation. So
no food to eat.
No food, lots of sickness, no medical care. A doctor would not come unless you could pay him. So people were really, really in a bad situation. And she was so shocked by this that she wrote her report, filed that with Harry Hopkins, and then called Eleanor from her hotel room. And Eleanor actually drove herself down the next day to tour this place and see for herself.
We need to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Kelly O'Connor McNeese about these two women, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, journalist Lorena Hickok, and a little bit more about the relationship they played in the New Deal. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from the U of I Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, presenting Saturday Engineering for Everyone at the ECE Building on Wright Street. This Saturday at 10 a.m., Professor Romit Roy Chowdhury presents Smartphones, Smart Homes, and Smart Cities, A Typical Day in 2030. go.ece.illinois.edu/c.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Chicago-based writer Kelly O'Connor McNeese. Her latest book that's just out is called Undiscovered Country, and it's a historical fiction account of the true life story and relationship between former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and the journalist Lorena Hickok. When we think about, I think it's really important, the context of where America was at the time. When you're describing the conditions just before the break that these folks were in, I think we kind of forget that this is pre-having any kind of government help for these situations.
Yes, absolutely. So many of the programs that we take for granted now, such as Social Security, is something that came out of the New Deal era. But before that, people were absolutely on their own and depending on their own community networks for care of the elderly. These are people, especially in these rural areas, who were very, very cut off from the rest of the country in terms of communication, in terms of transportation. So it was a different time.
And you yourself, did you actually drive from Chicago to West Virginia as part of the research for this book?
I did.
What was that like?
It was very interesting. And Arthurdale, which is the New Deal community that was built during this time, and this was Eleanor's pet project, something I go into in the book, basically helping these families who were living in tents get homes, get a little bit of small land where they could garden, and become a little bit more self-sufficient so that they weren't just living in squalor. This place is still there. Some of the homes, the original homes, are still there, and part of it is now a museum. So I was able to go and see one of the first homes that was built and sort of see the kind of amenities that Eleanor made sure these families had. Things like refrigerators, things like hot water heaters. This was really state-of-the-art technology for Appalachia in the 1930s.
And bathrooms,
indoor plumbing. And she met a lot of resistance from conservatives who did not think that money should be spent on these kinds of comforts, that, you know, it's one thing to build a shack for someone, but to give them these updated technologies, that she was really going over the top to help these people.
And I think you get a sense in the book, I appreciate a sense of Eleanor Roosevelt's personality, of really kind of a force of nature. I wonder how you set about creating the character of Eleanor Roosevelt in your book, how much of that was based on these letters and other historical accounts of just her personality and what she wanted to accomplish in life.
Yes, you're right. She was a force of nature. And in researching her, one thing that you find is that she just had an absolutely massive network of friends and colleagues and people who she communicated with. She wrote just tons and tons of correspondence with people every single day. She had a lot of projects that she was very passionate about. You know, she wasn't involved in things because she thought the optics looked good. In fact, sometimes her optics were terrible, according to the standards of that time, for a woman to be involved in as many things as she was and to be so forthright about getting what she wanted. She knew she was a very good politician. She knew how to bring certain groups of people together to make things happen. She knew how to run committees and make plans that would actually be executed and show progress. She just worked harder than everyone. So no one could say that, you know, she was making orders from on high, because she was always putting in, you know, 12, 18 hour days to get things done. And once she got an idea that she cared about, she just would not stop until she accomplished it. And that's something that really comes through in all different kinds of sources about her work.
And do you think that the role that she played in helping shape the New Deal, do you think that that's an interesting aspect that comes out in the book that I wonder how much is understood by people when they look back on the actual history of what happened?
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that's really interesting to think about. And again, for a historical fiction writer, as you're researching through official documents and official accounts of policy decisions and things like that, we have to sort of be skeptical sometimes of what the official record says, because we have to think that if she was playing a big role, there are certain people in the room, certain men in the room who may have wanted to downplay the role that she played, who may have wanted to downplay the influence she had over FDR's decisions. So I think that there's been some more thoughtful research into this and writing about this, and she's sort of finally getting her due in terms of how much influence she really did have on policy. And, you know, people would joke at the time that she was sort of like a co-president. And in some ways that really was true, because she never spent a day, you know, just planning tea parties in the White House. She knew the issues that she cared about. And sometimes she and FDR disagreed about things. And he admitted to that. But they really always listened to each other. And, you know, despite the problems they may have had in their personal relationship and then their marriage, they really were colleagues. And he respected her opinion maybe more than anyone of his advisors.
I'm speaking with Kelly O'Connor McNee. She's the author of Undiscovered Country. Kelly, how much research did you put into this? It's a historical fiction account, but as all of sort of the major points of the book, it seems like are based on real life examples. The trip that they take together, the First Lady coming down after Hick calls her to say, you have to come down and see what's happening here in West Virginia. The trips that Hick herself made across the country. How much research, how long did you spend researching this?
Well, it was sort of an ongoing process as I was drafting, to sort of, you know, write a chapter and then need to do more homework, more digging. So several years for sure, and sort of in lots of different directions, lots of research into these federal investigators, what their jobs were like, all the places that they traveled. And then research too into Hicks' own biography, which not that much was known. So I really did a lot of digging to learn more about her childhood and her early career as a journalist. Her upbringing could not have been more different from Eleanor's. She was born very poor and left home at 15 to sort of work lots of different jobs to try to take care of herself and work her way up as a journalist. She always was very independent, always lived alone. She did have one relationship prior to her time with Eleanor where she had lived with her partner. But for the most part, she was sort of a lone wolf, an unusual woman who really did not feel like she fit anywhere.
And I think part of that, I wonder, did you also do a research into what it would have been like for women at the time to have been together? And I think there's maybe a little bit more scholarship or historical attention paid to men and maybe gay relationships that were conducted sort of under the radar. But I don't know if that exists for women and for lesbian relationships.
You know, I think yes, like anything else, women's experiences have gotten a lot less attention and introspection than men's. I think that it's an unusual situation because Eleanor was one of the most famous people in the country at that time and very easily recognizable. So, of course, they had to be thoughtful about how they spent their time and where they could go. I think they were taking a huge risk to be together. At the same time, I was surprised in researching to learn how much they did just go out to dinner together and go to the opera together. Eleanor would go over to Hicks' apartment for dinner. So I think in some ways, because we live in this hyper documented time with everything online and social media, we have a hard time imagining what it would be like for them to sort of live in peace and just go about their business. But I think there was a lot more space given to especially the president and his family and more respect given to their privacy than there would be now.
This most recent book that you wrote is kind of a pattern of writing a lot about women. Is that a choice or is that something that's come organically for you as a writer?
Well, I would say both. It is a choice, but it is something that I am interested in and always have been, which is the stories of women's lives that, you know, as you said, the things that we haven't learned so much about and things that are in the footnotes of history that actually deserve to be examined more deeply and might actually shift our perspective on a lot of things that we take for granted about how the way things were. Just knowing the impact that Hick made on Eleanor's personal life as well as her professional life changes the story, changes the narrative that we were talking about in the beginning of who Eleanor was and what her life was about. And, you know, we need to know these stories. So that's what really drives me.
In addition to writing your own books, you also help other aspiring writers. You have a company called Wordbird Editorial, and there's copywriting and other services. But you also do things like you evaluate people's manuscripts and you help them pitch their own book ideas. What's it like to shift your audience from that of a reader, like when you're writing a book, to, say, putting on the mindset of an agent or a publisher?
I really enjoy doing that work. I really enjoy helping other writers with their work. I think that it gives me a good perspective. I actually worked as an editor before my books were published, so I've been at this for a long time. But I think having the experience of being a writer myself and knowing what it's like to work with an editor and receive criticism on my work and try to revise a project and get it closer to what my vision is for it gives me a lot of, you know, empathy for them coming to me for help. And I'm always trying to think about how I can help them work on their craft and make their books the best possible version of them that they can be. I really enjoy that collaboration. And I just love writing and love talking about books and stories. So it's just another way of being a part of that community.
Is it hard too, though, because you always have writers' egos, but then you also have their work that they've spent so much time on, having to critique that?
Sure. I mean, I think it depends on what their goals are. You know, sometimes people come to you and you can tell that what they really, really want is just to be published, but they aren't invested in the craft of writing. They aren't invested in learning to be a better writer and to really doing the work that needs to be done to take a book from a first draft through all of the rounds of revision that you need to put it through in order to have something special happen. And the special thing doesn't always happen with every book. But, you know, most people come because they really do want to learn. And, you know, they care about what they're writing about. They are really invested in it. And they just need someone to help them make a plan for what to do next with their revision.
Does that help you with your own writing?
Absolutely. Because, you know, there are only so many plot problems under the sun that kind of come up in these sessions with them, and sort of brainstorming ideas about, you know, if you've written yourself into a corner, how to write your way back out of it again definitely has, you know, yielded ideas for me that I've been able to apply to other projects, just strategies and techniques for what to do when you're stuck, what to do when you're really depressed about something just not working, how to get unstuck.
So, Kelly, before we let you go, we've been talking about letters. You wrote some in the voice of Eleanor to Hick. Can you share one?
Okay. So this is a letter from Eleanor to Hick on December 21st, 1932. My darling Hick, it has been a devil of a day, and I cannot sleep. I am still thinking about those homeless families in the park and how we have failed them and what it means to lose one's home. I imagine that when most people hear the name Roosevelt, they think of a life of privilege, and of course they would be right. It might surprise some to learn, however, that I myself have never had a home of my own. As a girl, I was whisked away to my grandmother's house when my parents died, then off to boarding school, then marriage, after which I lived in my mother-in-law's house, and under her thumb, which you are welcome to print once she has passed away. When Franklin entered public service, we lived in a rented house in Washington, and later the governor's mansion in Albany, and now it is off to the White House. Some would call that the best address in the land, but I might take issue with that claim. What is a home, really, but a warm, dry place with a comfortable chair and a table filled with the ones you love? That, the freedom and privacy of that place, is something I have not known. I hope it won't sound to you as though I am complaining. All over this land, as I write, there are people suffering in ways I cannot imagine. Hunger, sickness, and despair. It can bring me to my knees if I let it. But what I do think I have a little knowledge of is the forlorn heart of one who has no place of refuge that is all her own, however humble it might appear. I hope when I am gone, someone might say of me that I tried to make of that displaced feeling some good action that changed things for the better, that put more solid roofs over the heads of my fellow citizens. I see now how my work is just beginning, and I am getting all kinds of notions about the programs and things I'd like to do, that I intend to do, and watch out or I will recruit you for the effort. Though for now I am content, my darling, to make my home in the crook of your elbow, in the soft shelter of your chin, how I miss you every minute we're apart. Nora.
Kelly O'Connor McNeese is the author of Undiscovered Country. If you're in the Chicago area, she's actually doing a reading on Monday at 6:30. It's sponsored by Read Between the Lines Independent Bookstore in Woodstock. We will tweet out details of that. Kelly, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Yes, it's May the 4th. May the 4th be with you. Get it? Of course. In addition to terrible Star Wars puns, tomorrow is also Free Comic Book Day. Since Disney owns Marvel and Lucasfilm, Marvel publishes Star Wars comics. And tomorrow is a day where comic book fans flock to stores around the country. As the industry is changing, much like publishing, to see a lot of growth online, we thought we would talk about the brick and mortar as well as online presence of a few Illinois comic book stores. So on the line with us, two comic book store managers. River Hardrick is manager of G-Mart Comics in Chicago. They also have a store in Champaign. Kevin Healy is with us from DeKalb, where he's store manager of Graham Cracker Comic Books. That's one of 10 locations they have throughout Illinois. They also have a store in Madison, Wisconsin. Also on the line with us from Chicago is Oliver Seva, head comics writer for the AV Club. Guys, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Hello.
Oliver, can we start with you? Can you give us a brief rundown of what the idea is behind Free Comic Day?
Sure. So Free Comic Book Day was started 17 years ago. I think that was right after the first Spider-Man movie, either Spider-Man or X-Men movie. But basically, it was a way for like brick-and-mortar comic book stores to capitalize on interest in these big-screen properties, taking advantage of kind of the summertime season, and different publishers would release one book, maybe two books, that are a story that is either an original story or a reprinted story that comic shops could just give out to customers for free. Comic shops do have to pay for those, and I think that our other two guests could get into that a little bit more, but for the most part, it's really just a celebration of the medium that has grown pretty much every year. New publishers are kind of expanding the scope of the kind of books you can get on Free Comic Book Day. And for me, it's kind of when it feels like the summer starts. But I'm also in Chicago, where it's cold right up until the very beginning.
Yeah, well, as we've seen this week, right? River, is Free Comic Book Day like your Black Friday for comic book stores?
Yeah, pretty much. When we open, we have lines down the block. It's a little bit more of a party atmosphere than Black Friday, though. People dress up. They come out with like costumes and props. It's really a lot of fun.
Kevin, what's it like for you with Graham Cracker Comic Book? Same thing?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, it's our most fun day of the year, combined with the hardest day of the year to work. But it's such a fun day to work because of the atmosphere that you would never associate any of the malaise that goes along with Black Friday with it.
Oliver, can I ask you, with Avengers coming out this past weekend, breaking records, becoming the highest opening weekend ever, and we've seen such success with that franchise when we're talking about even just this year, if we're thinking about Black Panther and now this first part of the two-part finale of The Avengers. Do you think we're in a golden age of comic book-oriented movies right now?
Yeah, I mean, the movies right now are kind of more superhero-oriented, but that is kind of the way that a lot of the general public, like that's the thing that people associate with the comic book media more than anything else. But in terms of superhero stuff, I think it's kind of hard to deny that we're not in, if not a golden age, just a time of really interesting experimentation with these properties. Marvel Studios is a little bit more conservative, I feel, because everything is so tied together. But over at Fox, you have movies like Deadpool, which are taking the genre in a new direction. A movie like Logan, that is a Western that is R-rated and really violent, but it fits the tone of that character in a way that other movies haven't in the past. You can't deny that they're just incredibly popular. So I definitely think it's a huge boom period. I don't know if the bust is coming, honestly. Marvel's been able to sustain their momentum for 10 years now. But the thing is, I want to see that translate to comic sales as well. And I think there's been difficulty in getting all those Avengers fans to read an ongoing Avengers comic.
River, can I ask you about that? I wonder if you've seen increased interest in comics since the movies got going, or if it's translating to more people reading?
We definitely see new people coming in whenever one of the new movies comes out. I think Black Panther has actually been the biggest one for us. We had a hard time even keeping the Black Panther comics on the shelf after the movie. People really want to know more about the character and the world he lived in. and kind of his backstory. So people were buying everything from like the new stuff that was coming out that week to old stuff that was coming out in like the 80s and 90s, just wanting to find out everything they could about Black Panther.
And Kevin, can I ask you, in terms of not just Black Panther, I will not, by the way, for everyone listening, if you haven't seen the Avengers movie, this is not a spoiler, but I think it's safe to say it ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. And Kevin, does it have more people come in also because of the Avengers movie because they want to see what happens in the comic book universe?
We've had some traffic that way, and it's a little difficult to direct them right now, as some of the stories that the Infinity War movie are loosely based on don't have the exact same payoff. So where to direct them to next? There are tons of quality books involving Thanos and the Infinity Gauntlet and any number of different scenarios where bad things have happened to good people. But the specific place that they're looking for, we don't have that. So for people who are shopping, looking specifically for show me part four before part four comes out, we can only direct them to quality books that already exist and hope that they're going to find enjoyment in those. And since the comics have a little more room to be a little more daring than maybe their on-screen counterparts ever get to be, hopefully the interest in reading continues when we put a good book in their hands.
And are you seeing that, Kevin? It sounds like you're trying to help folks and direct their attention to comics. Are you seeing in general more people coming in to River's point about Black Panther?
Absolutely. I would 100% agree with River. It was the largest fresh audience that we had after a superhero film. But I think as a superhero film, it was appealing to an underserved audience, which led to a greater awareness of where you would go to find the material that character originally came from.
And Oliver, to that point about diversity, at one point, Ta-Nehisi Coates was writing the Black Panther comics along with Roxane Gay. And I think she's now writing, is she writing a new Secret series for Marvel?
She's hinted at having more work for Marvel. And Ta-Nehisi Coates is still writing Black Panther. He's actually going to have a new number one in, I think, a couple weeks. They're like relaunching it to take advantage of some of this movie momentum, give readers like a fresh place to jump on. It actually sounds really cool. It's like Black Panther in space. It's like a Wakanda on another planet. But another interesting thing is that Ta-Nehisi Coates is going to be writing Captain America starting in July, and that's one of the books that is available for free comic book day. There is Marvel has two one-shots. One of them is Avengers and Captain America, and then another one is Infinity Wars and Spider-Man. And I'm really excited about the Avengers Captain America one. Very curious to see what Coates does on Captain America. It's a pretty big change for the character, who I really can't think of any time a Black writer has written that character. Christopher Priest, I guess, and that's kind of the only one that can pop into my head. But yeah, Marvel still has kind of a ways to go. But that's one of the things I really like about Free Comic Book Day, is that it does show off a lot more of the diversity of things outside of DC and Marvel, because there is this huge world and comics can be kind of expensive. So when you have an opportunity to try things for free, it gives people a taste of something they might not have experienced before.
We're talking about Free Comic Book Day with Oliver Seva. He's the head comics writer for the AV Club. River Hardrick is also on the line with us from Chicago, where she's the manager of G-Mark Comics. They also have a location in Champaign. On the line with us from DeKalb is Kevin Healy. He is the store manager of Graham Cracker Comic Books. They've got locations all throughout Illinois. Kevin, River, I wanted to ask you guys about that. I guess maybe it's more of a mainstream idea of Marvel in DC, and they're doing a lot of the movies, so they're getting a lot of attention. What do you guys like, what you're sort of excited about in terms of new voices or diverse voices, or to Oliver's point about experimentation? River, can I ask you who you're interested in reading these days?
I read a little bit of everything, but I've been really excited the last couple of years about anything Brian K. Vaughan's putting out. He does a book called Saga that's been our bestseller for, I think, about the last 2 years. And he's got a book coming out for Free Comic Book Day, Barrier. And it's kind of like a new take on things. It's outside the superhero genre, so it sort of expands what people think of when they're thinking of comics. It's something different and a little bit new.
Kevin, what about you?
I would agree with everything River just said. And in addition to Vaughn, Rick Remender is a writer who, even going back to his superhero days at Marvel, was always a little off in all the best ways possible. He has a book called Deadly Class that whenever we get a chance to put that in somebody's hand, the true story of, and I should qualify true as being completely untrue, a boy whose parents are killed when somebody commits suicide jumping off of a bridge. He blames Ronald Reagan. This is set during the Reagan presidency, and joins a school of teenage assassins so he can eventually work his way up to the president.
Wow. Okay, there's a plot. Kevin, can I also ask you guys about how people are consuming comics these days? Is it more an electronic form than the actual hard comic book?
That would be difficult for me to say, as we don't have a digital format available via our company to have any records for that. I can say, as far as people consuming in our store, we have seen a shift from monthly issues to a patient audience waiting for the graphic novel version. Now, while there are original graphic novels, many stories that are collected both from the superhero and independent genres will be collected one full story arc at a time. And that is almost preferred medium, it seems, for a good number of our shoppers. River's example of Saga. Saga Volume 1 has been one of the best three selling books in our store for 3 years running. It simply can't be stopped. A quality product you can put a chunk of in somebody's hand will normally get them back in to want to see more. I think it's akin to binge watching a show on Netflix.
And what advice do you guys have for people who, if people are thinking about coming out to Free Comic Book Day, who you might encourage them to read? River?
I think it depends on the person, honestly. When a new person comes in, especially for something like Free Comic Book Day, there's so many choices. There's something for everyone. We like to ask them, you know, what movies they like, what TV shows they like. There's a new Nightmare Before Christmas comic coming out on Free Comic Book Day that will be good for, you know, for some people. Although they say they really like horror, there's something called Shadow Roads that's a little creepier, a little bit weirder. But basically, there's something for everyone. There's not really a one-size-fits-all comic that's coming out. And I think that's the best thing about Free Comic Book Day. People who don't get a chance throughout the year to come into a comic store can come in and just sample a couple things for free and see what clicks, even if it's not what they normally think of, not, you know, a superhero comic.
Hey, Kevin, how's it going to work for Graham Cracker Comic Books? How many free comic books are you going to have available then?
So you can get 3 free books per person, and we always encourage people to grab something you wouldn't normally read. The price is right. It's the exact right time to try something new. But for anybody who stops in a costume, we always give them 3 extra books on top of that. If they're willing to travel between our stores, you could come home with as many as 66 different books in a single day.
River, do you have the costume rule too?
We do, yes. We do 5 free comics per person and 10 for people who come in costume. And then we've got more opportunities for free comics throughout the day for people who want to, like, hang out and try playing some board games or, you know, let kids take pictures of them in their costumes, things like that.
I'd love for people to be nice to your comic shop owners when you go in. If they're out of something, please remember that they did buy that and had it there for you to give away.
And that you are ideally there to buy something else from the comic shop.
Great. Well, we are almost out of time, but I want to encourage everybody to visit their local comic book store tomorrow. It's Free Comic Book Day. We will tweet out details and have more details at our website at 21stshow.org. But I want to thank Kevin Healy, store manager for Graham Cracker's Comic Books in DeKalb. River Hardrick is the manager of G-Mart Comics in Chicago. And Oliver Sava for being with us as well, head comics writer for the AV Club. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
That does it for us today. Let's end the weekend with some music appropriate for May the 4th and for Free Comic Book Day tomorrow. As I said, you could head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information about how to follow us on social media, leave us a voicemail, send us an email, directions for listening to past shows. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Fatima Farha is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great weekend.